The Dolo White Podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. Follow Cinema Anywhere Nashville on Instagram and book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience today. Hey, it's Dolo White, and this is the Dolo White Podcast. It feels good to be back. Hope your holidays went well and all that other shit. Moving on, let's get to it. My first guest of the new year is Roanne Van Voorst. She's a futures anthropologist and author of the new book, Once Upon a Time We Ate Animals, which looks into the future of food. And if you're a meat eater, listen to this. You may find some bad news in this episode. I'm kidding. Kind of. Let's get it started. Welcome to the Dolo White Podcast.
Polo Gini. Live.
Yo, what's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolo White Podcast.
Episode 58 now, the Dolo White Podcast. My guest today, futures anthropologist and author of Once Upon a Time We Ate Animals, The Future of Food, Roanne Van Voorst. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book basically looks at what the planet would look like if everybody just stopped and became vegan, correct?
Yeah, or at least, you know, parts of the world where it's really easy and accessible to get plant-based alternatives. So I don't believe the whole world will join, not really soon. Like, you know, I'm an anthropologist, so I travel a lot. I've done a lot of field work, for example, in Greenland, where people really have to live off whales because they have no vegetables growing on the ice. There, I can't really see them have Beyond Burgers within now and 5 years. But in the Western bubbles or in the urban bubbles and settings where it's so easy, yes, there I can really see a shift going on. Something that always reminds me of smoking, right? When I was a kid, it was really normal to smoke on a children's birthday parties. For many adults would be sitting in the room just smoking and
right.
Nobody thought it was offensive or unhealthy. But now if you would do that, we would all be like, okay, that's very weird. Could you please do this outside? It's not good. And I can imagine, you know, now that we know so much of the emissions that are caused by the food industry and large industrial farming, that at some point we will find eating meat antisocial if you have an alternative. And I really wrote the book because I thought, I think we have enough information. Like, I'm not the very first person telling that there is a relationship between climate changes and the meat industry, for example. I don't think it's that is lacking. It's not that is hampering us from changing our behavior. I think the problem is that we can't really imagine a different world. And as long as you can't really imagine, then why would you move towards it, right? You don't even know where to move. And it kind of feels like, yeah, I can change my behavior, but then the rest of the world is not, and China is not. And, you know, everybody's eating meat, and then I'm the only dumb person suffering for this thing. That's how many people feel. And I totally feel them. But if you see the trends going, and if you look at the statistics, and if you have a picture of how it could look like, it probably becomes more interesting. And that's what I wanted to do in the book.
I think, especially here in America, you're in Amsterdam, correct?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so my wife and I we've been to Europe quite a few times. But even there, it's like your meat is the main course. And then absolutely. Everything else that you cook with a meal is the sides. It goes around the meat. I would think that would be the hardest, at least for me, for us, that was kind of the hardest thing for me to break mentally, was to say, doesn't have to be this way. The meat doesn't have to be the center of the meal. You can get rid of that and still have a great meal in front of you.
Yeah. And I think that's a whole different way of cooking and of shopping. And I sometimes think that we don't talk about this enough. You know, sometimes when people have gone vegan, especially the social influencers you see on Instagram, they make it sound as if it was no transition at all. And I don't think it's a hard transition, but it's a transition.
Absolutely.
And you'll have to do a little bit of research on what works and how you can change recipes. Because what I think a lot of people do wrong, quote unquote, when they start to be vegetarian or vegan, is that they want to make the same things that they grew up with, like, you know, potatoes, meat, veggies, but then they just take out the meat and then you end up with potatoes and veggies. Like, no, that's not healthy. And it's also not really good. So this behavioral change is not going to be sustainable, guys. What you want to do is you want to start with the veggies, for example. You want to think like, oh, I'm going to make something with broccoli tonight, or I'm going to make something with sweet potato, and then think around it instead of having the meat center stage. But that demands a bit of practice. Once you get the knack, it's not that heart. And, you know, there's Google nowadays, and that's really helpful. You just type in easy vegan recipes and it's all over the place.
Yeah.
My big thing was having to cook without egg. And I tried, and I describe in the book as well, I completely destroyed my first pancakes without eggs. I don't know what I was doing. My back then partner kept saying, like, this is not eatable. And I kept saying, oh, it is, just a little bit more maple syrup. It's not that bad, you know, but I was lying. It was horrible. And I just had to relearn to cook, but it cost me like 3 times of trying. You know, it's not rocket science.
Right. So let's get into the book a little bit more. Now, you said already that you thought one day meat will be kind of like cigarettes. How far in the future is that to you?
You know, I have a double background. So I'm an anthropologist. I obtained my PhD in anthropology, but then I'm also a professionally trained futurist. And so as a futurist, you're basically trained to sketch realistic future scenarios. And you do that on the basis of expert interviews, on the basis of literature, and also having a sense for the trend. And then as an anthropologist, I go and deep dive in such a scenario. Right. And I try to understand how would that impact society and individuals. For this topic, I keep being confused. I have to be honest. I do see a change. Like, you see a huge growth in flexitarianism mostly. But also the youngsters are really more experimenting with becoming full vegetarians or even becoming full vegans. And that's really promising if that's part of the agenda, if that's part of your agenda, because it means that, you know, they're small now, so they're still kind of having to eat what the parents give them. But in a couple of years, they are the ones with the wallets, right? And so you see, for the youngsters, you see so much concern about the climate. You see the whole climate anxiety phenomenon. You see that they are growing up with all those documentaries that you now have on Netflix and whatnot and on the meat industry. So for them, it becomes really hard to understand, like, guys, why are you still eating meat? Everybody knows this. Why are we not doing the vegan stuff? You know, and so that is telling us that this can go really fast. And some of the estimations say veganism is one of the most fast growing social movements in the world. I'm just too much of a social scientist to be not critical there, because it's really hard to measure. I think some people go vegan for a couple of years and then they go back to vegetarianism. A lot of people go flexitarian. And then, of course, there's also countries where we're still seeing a growth in meat industry, for example. So China, you know, for a lot of people who never were able to afford it before to eat meat, and they've seen the West doing it all the time. And so now they're catching up, which I can totally understand. I always tell people as well, on a side note, the average Chinese still eats a lot less meat on a daily basis than the average American. So we shouldn't, you know, blame them for what we are doing. But I find it really hard. I've said it takes place in 2030, but all that is in the book is already happening, right? So all the interviews I conducted, that's interviews with actual people, like, for example, farmers who already transitioned to producing lupine beans or soybeans or seaweed. They already exist all over the world. And some of them do it because they were no longer comfortable with having to scale up and scale up and scale up until you have so many animals that it becomes a factory. While most farmers or livestock keepers choose that profession because they like animals and then it doesn't feel good. And others transition because they say it's just really lucrative. I mean, for the future, this is the trend. So I think 2030 is really optimistic. But I often say, like, somewhere in 20 years, I see this really happening. So that's a full new generation, basically, right?
I feel like with anything, with any big change, there's always like negative consequences, no matter how positive the movement is. So I think veganism, vegetarianism, obviously great for the planet. I feel better since I stopped eating meat personally. But what are some of the, I guess, consequences? What would be some of the things that maybe we haven't thought of? Like, I think when you're vegan or vegetarian, you always think this is nothing bad is happening now. This is all this, everything is great. But that might not always be the case, right?
No, I think, well, first of all, you know, for some farmers or livestock keepers, it has been such an identity, like a proud identity for so many decades, right? Mm-hmm. And I talked to farmers who said, I was always proud that I was the one serving the milk to my country because I was always born and raised to think that that was a really healthy thing. And then he turned vegan because his doctor told him to do so for his health. And he felt so much better. And then he kind of was confused, like, oh, so, you know, you don't need it, apparently. So what am I doing then? And I think if you see a transition, then that can be a loss for a lot of people. Like, oh, I used to be this. And now apparently suddenly I'm no longer appreciated for what I do. Or so that's one thing. Another thing is that even if you eat vegan or if you only have plant-based produce, it still costs land, it still costs water. It will be less, but it will still be a puzzle of where do you place all these things, especially in the beginning, because we now have so much degraded land with all the livestock there that it will take years before that land is good. So I don't think this is going to be an overnight thing. And then finally, I think what I find a bit dangerous nowadays is that veganism is becoming so popular also on social media that some people think it's necessarily the case that if you eat anything vegan, you will be super healthy. Well, you know, there's a lot of crap out there as well, just like there is in non-vegan lifestyle. So I think that if people make the shift, you know, most of the research shows that indeed, in general, vegans are a bit more healthy than people who eat a lot of meat. But health is dependent of many things. And I think if we make the shift, we need to be informed a little bit. And you don't want to eat things with lists of ingredients that you can't pronounce, which are also available in the vegan lifestyle community. And also, I think probably, even though it has a lot of health benefits, generally speaking, probably the best reason to become vegan is not necessarily for the health, or the worst reason is because you think that you'll lose kilos with it, which is something that a lot of people think, but it's also not necessarily the case. Like, I love my plant-based burgers. It's not going to help me lose kilos, right? So I think there's sometimes myths on both sides of the spectrum. Sometimes there's the myth like, oh, but human beings have always eaten meat. No, we haven't. We've been vegetarians for a large part of human history. But then there's also the myths on the other side of the spectrum, like, oh, I'll just turn vegan and then I'll lose 10 kilos. So I think, you know, this is going to be an interesting transition where we have to kind of stick to reading perhaps not opinions and blogs, but meta-analysis, which I tried to collect and use for the book. But we'll also see a change into new realms. And that means saying goodbye to, for example, you know, the chicken soup your mom always used to make you when you were ill. And it's not that bad. We can reinvent a new tradition, but it may feel a little bit sad.
I always tell people, you know, sugar is vegan. So, and you can definitely have too much of that, right? Exactly. Captain Crunch is vegan. I eat it quite a bit. I did want to ask you about the vegan movement in Europe as a whole. We haven't been back to Europe since we both kind of transitioned to vegetarianism and veganism. And one thing we used to love to do is go and eat food. And now it's like, okay. So are some European countries better than others? Where you're at in Amsterdam, how is it there? You know, recommendations if you plan to travel.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the same in the US though. It's more in urban setting. Mm-hmm. It's just so easy to eat vegan. In more rural setting, it's harder. You can still do it. You know, I always tell people like, oh, well, if you know, pasta with tomato sauce is vegan, you know, it's not that difficult. If you just give me a little tapenade on a piece of bread as a starter, you know, it's vegan. It doesn't have to be so complicated, but people might be less familiar with it. But even there in supermarkets, you'll see soy yogurt instead of cow's yogurt as an option as well. So it's growing, but in the cities, it's spectacularly easy. If you're in Amsterdam, it's not a problem. London, Berlin is really a vegan Walhalla in Germany. So that's really a good one. But even, I mean, the whole Italian kitchen, for example, you know, sure, there's lots of meat and fish there as well, but many of the pastas are vegan. That's just the recipe. So I think sometimes it sounds more daunting than it really is. If you just go back to the simple recipes, then many of the kitchens have a central role for veggies. I think South America might be harder, unless you're in big cities. But because, you know, if you go to Paraguay or Uruguay or Argentina, then, you know, the steaks are really a big thing. And so then it might be a bit more of a struggle. But here in Europe, you're going to be safe. And I promise you to share my best restaurants if you're in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. I'm going to take you up on that. I saw something on the sheet here that I found interesting. It said, why veganism in couples can lead to fights and breakups. So talk about that for a second, because I thought that was very interesting.
Well, first of all, you have the phenomenon, and it's a growing phenomenon. It's not a super big group, but they're growing, and they are called the vegan sexuals. And they only want to date people who are also vegan like them, because they say, well, then I share my values. And I also find it just really practical, because we don't have to fuzz around, you know, food or what we want in the fridge or not. But that's more of a rigid group, I would say. And then there's a growing group of mixed couples. And you are part of a mixed couple, but you might also be part of a mixed couple if you are vegetarian and your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever is carnivore, you know, or is a carnist, as we often call it in vegan jargon, which I always think it's funny because it just shows that it's another culture around food, right? You have carnism and then you have veganism. But I spoke to a Harvard psychologist about this, and in the book she gives great tips, actually, because she does say it can lead to friction, especially if you turn vegetarian for principal reasons, like, oh, I don't feel comfortable with the suffering caused to animals, for example. And you see your partner continue to eat that, it might seem as if he or she doesn't care. And that can be really complicated. And then vice versa, what happened to me when I turned vegan, I was so shocked by everything I read. And this was a new thing that I was really annoying, constantly talking about it while my back then partner just wanted to have a nice dinner. And I would be like, isn't it amazing? Do you know how many eggs per day? Like, how many chickens do we kill per day? It was horrible, you know? And so the psychologist, Melanie Joy, gives in my book really nice tips, I think, for how you can still find each other, because underlying the annoyances is still different motivations. Like, I just want to be taken seriously, that, you know, this is really concerning for me and this touches me. And the other person says, yeah, but what is really important for me is that we have some time where it's just cozy and not just all political talk. And that is something that you can get to. And I actually think that this tip, the tips that I share in the book, are not just good for couples, but also for, you know, in your family, for example, or in friend groups, because this is a growing movement and you will have more mixed whatever relationships.
It blows people's mind when I tell them that I don't eat meat anymore, just because the amount of meat that I used to eat when growing up, and people will be like, you grew up on meat. And I'm like, yes, I know, but I did a lot of other things when I was young too that I don't do anymore. So, you know, it's a hard concept for a lot of people to wrap their minds around. And I think especially in a country, I don't know if you guys learned this in Europe or not, but I mean, we learned about four major food groups, two of which were dairy and meat. And so you just cut out 50% of the food groups that you learned about when you're growing up. And I think that's hard for people to wrap their minds around.
Absolutely. And it's the same in Europe. I think a lot of people grew up with this idea. We actually had a very active government campaign when I was growing up, where you were taught to drink 3 cups of milk per day, because they thought that that would strengthen your bones, right?
Yeah.
And now, 2 decades later or 3 decades later, they say, well, we never found really the evidence for that. And instead, we see more and more babies getting lactose intolerant. But for a while, they really thought that that was necessary.
Yeah.
And so then if you say, I'll stop, and this is a thing that a lot of people that go vegan will notice, suddenly people become really concerned with your health. And it's like, I remember when I turned vegan while writing this book, because I was never an activist before, or whatever. I'm still not, I'm a scientist, but I was never vegan before. I turned vegan, and my dad, bless him, comes in and brings me vitamin B pills. And I'm like, Dad, I'm 33 years old. And when I was a teenager and I was surviving on Snickers and Mars bars and cola, you never gave me vitamin pills.
Right.
But now you're concerned. And this is something that a lot of people experience, right? It's insane. Like, oh, but where did you get your protein? And they don't know that most people are not protein deficient in our country.
Right.
Not the vegans either. We eat quite easily enough proteins, because it's in everything. It's in the oatmeal. It's in the peanut butter. It's in the green veggies, you know, so it's pretty easy to get enough protein, unless you really want to build muscle. And then it might make sense to have a protein shake based on plants. But, you know,
those are easy to find, too. Final question before I let you out of here. And I ask this anytime I do an episode about plant-based diets and things like that, I always ask the guest, Do you think that it was meant for, that human beings were meant to consume meat? Just the way we're structured, were we meant to consume that?
I mean, if you were to walk outside in the street and you would encounter a cow, but you would not wear any weapons on you, then I wish you really good luck with eating that cow. We don't really have sharp teeth. We can't really open our mouths like dogs or wolves can, or lions. So it becomes really hard. I don't think that eating meat is unhealthy necessarily. Right. I think human bodies are meant to eat quite a lot of things, or at least we can handle a lot of things. We can handle a lot of sugary things as well, but we're not really made for it. We're not meant to be hunters, as in without weapons. We really needed to invent weapons and fire in order to be able to eat as much meat as we now do, or started doing. But I think in the earlier days, when we scavenged and just had a little bit of meat from the bones of the dead animals that other animals had already killed, I think that was okay. And our tummies really, you know, adapted to eating meat. But if you would give a person from way back a huge steak, they would probably not be able to tolerate it. You know, we really had to go through changes bodily, and I describe them in the book, in order to be able to eat as much meat as we now can. So I think we're okay with a little bit of meat, especially fish, like things like that, because we were able to catch them as well, but not necessarily to be the hunters that we always present ourselves to be, you know, as humankind.
Thank you so much for doing this. Once Upon a Time We Ate Animals, The Future of Food is the book. Roanne Van Voorst, thank you so much for doing this.
It was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. You can book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience right now, starting at only $350. Cinema Anywhere Nashville provides your choice of a 16, 24, 36, or even 100-foot screen, plus projector setup and sound system. This is a super dope service that wouldn't just be great for corporate and work events, but also birthday and holiday parties, or if you want to have a romantic evening with your significant other. Cinema Anywhere Nashville is perfect for all of those things. They have the right experience for you. Follow them on Instagram right now at Cinema Anywhere Nashville and book your cinema experience today. Once again, I want to say thank you to my guest, Roanne Van Voorst. You can follow her on the gram right now at Roanne Van Voorst. And make sure you get her book, Once Upon a Time We Ate Animals. You can follow me as well at DolaWhite101, DolaWhite 101. And make sure you've subscribed and are following this podcast on whatever platform it is you use for your podcast. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, you know, go ahead and leave me 5 stars, a review, say some nice things, whatever it is you can do, whatever that platform lets you do, do that thing, that nice thing that'll take you 5 seconds. That would really help me out a lot. Brand new episode drops next Wednesday. My guest, author of the book Through the Banks of the Red Cedar, which takes a look at her father's NFL career during the Civil Rights Movement. My guest, Maya Washington, next week. Going to be a super dope episode. That's it. That's all. I'm gone. Thank you for checking out the podcast. Happy New Year. I'm out.